Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to research that improves health, reduces recovery times, and brings new treatments and therapies to our area before they're available elsewhere. More information is at upmcpinnacle.com.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Last December, the Federal Communications Commission repealed two-year-old net neutrality rules. Net neutrality barred big communications companies like Comcast or Verizon from interfering with internet traffic and favoring their own sites. Protests erupted across the country saying prices would rise and consumer choices could be limited. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro joined with 21 other states to sue the FCC over the repeal. Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro is with us this morning on his way to Philadelphia. General Shapiro, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you. And I'm going to try to do this radio interview in a way I've never done it before with a full car of my kids on the way to the Eagles parade. So we'll see how we do here.
All right. Well, I hate to sound like a parent or anything like this, but I expect you to behave and set an example for the other revelers in Philadelphia today, okay?
You will not find me atop any light post. We will be behaving and just celebrating what's an extraordinary victory and just a gutsy team that really represents the best of Philly. Just a great underdog story, and we're excited.
I'd rather be there by myself today, but duty calls. So let's talk about net neutrality. Why are you suing over the repeal of the net neutrality rules?
I think it's important to understand what net neutrality is and how it protects Pennsylvanians and really all Americans. Look, the internet is the First Amendment in action. Online, you can say what you want, read what you want, watch what you want, and the internet really helps us connect to others, whether it's for commercial purposes or spiritual purposes or social purposes. And basically, the ground rules have been that these internet service providers, the companies that provide internet to your home or to your business, Verizon, Comcast, not picking on them, but just citing them as examples, that they basically would give you the internet based on what you would pay. And then all websites, all streaming sites, all social media sites would be treated equally. So whether you were going to Facebook or Netflix or what have you, you'd get equal access to it. By doing away with net neutrality, what the FCC is basically doing is they're handing over the keys of the internet to these internet service providers and saying, you know what, Scott, we don't really want you to see Netflix, but we really want you to see Hulu, for example. So we're going to make Hulu lightning fast for you, but boy, Netflix is going to be really slow. And if you want Netflix to be the same speed as Hulu, boy, you're going to have to pay for that. And to me, I think that is fundamentally unfair. Furthermore, the way that the FCC went about promulgating this rule, I think, is unlawful. And so now let me get to the heart of your question, right? What does our lawsuit do? Our lawsuit, and I was joined by 21 other attorneys general from across the country, basically says a few things, but in a nutshell, that the FCC acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner in promulgating these rules. And furthermore, they violated the process that you have for setting up rules. And then lastly, what I'm also very concerned about is they took away my authority as a state attorney general to protect Pennsylvania consumers on the internet. And that is something that really concerns me as well. So for all of those reasons and more, we filed a lawsuit, and you know, we think we have a very good shot of overturning these efforts to gut net neutrality and restore these critical protections for consumers.
You know, we hear the words arbitrary and capricious often when it comes to filing a suit. For the non-lawyers listening today, myself included, what does that mean?
It basically means that they acted in a way that, you know, that was unfair, that was purposefully done in a way to either harm or benefit certain others, and really wasn't done to comport with the rule of law. I mean, that's a general way, I think, of explaining it. It's obviously more complex than that. There's legal tests, but that's a general way I'd explain it. Mm-hmm.
The basis for the repeal, according to the FCC, they gave several reasons, but they said that big data users like Netflix, for example, you used Netflix as an example, that they don't pay anything for the data usage that they do use, and they use more, and Hulu is another. I mean, you can say the example you gave of favoring one or the other, I understand that, but that those companies that depend on streaming for their business, that they are using a whole lot of data compared to a normal user, and they're not paying anything more for it. What do you say to that?
I don't think that that's a fair characterization of it. And remember that when you are interested in streaming, and I don't mean to pick on Netflix or Hulu, but we're using that as an example. When you're interested in streaming Netflix or Hulu or uploading your pictures to Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, you are, you know, making use of these internet service provider services, and they're getting paid for that. I mean, you still pay a monthly fee. You know, they're still doing quite well. No one at Comcast or Verizon is struggling. So they, yes, these sites draw down a lot of data, but by the same token, these internet service providers benefit from the relationships that exist that people have online and the streaming and the work that's done online.
You mentioned that for the basis of the suit that Pennsylvanians could be harmed. In what way? I mean, give us some examples in which Pennsylvanians could be harmed.
Sure. I mean, real simple. Right now, you pay a set fee each month to get your internet. And look, some people choose to pay more because they want faster internet. Some people may pay less. But the bottom line is every single website is treated the same. So they're not discriminating based on which site you go to. So the first thing is they could actually increase costs to access certain kinds of content. So they're saying, boy, if you want that speed to download from a particular website, you're going to now have to pay more for it. So that's one thing that is concerning to me, should be concerning to all Pennsylvanians. Second, they'd actually be able to block certain content on certain websites. And then third, they can reduce streaming speeds or throttle it back. And I guess the thing that I would ask every Pennsylvanian is, you know, do you really want your internet service provider deciding what content is okay for you to access and not? I mean, the beauty of the internet is that you can go on and access whatever you want and engage with whomever you want. Now, of course, there are some drawbacks to that, and there are, you know, challenges to that that we work on every day. But I don't think anybody wants a big internet service provider deciding what content they can get and how much they're going to pay to access a particular website. Furthermore, I think it can really harm small businesses. And this is a really key point. You know, think about, I use Netflix and Hulu as an example, so let's stick with that example. At some point, these were small startups just trying to get going. And then they eventually just took off, right? And they're incredibly successful streaming sites right now. But the reality is there's startups and small businesses each and every day that are trying to get going. And if they face the throttling of their speeds by an internet service provider and they can never get off the ground, that hurts small business. It hurts development on the internet. It hurts innovation. And it slows us all down, literally and figuratively. And that is something that concerns me as well and should concern any small business or startup that's out there.
You said, may put a halt to innovation. Actually, what the ISPs have said, the big ones have said that what they can do now, of course, I think what they're also talking about is raising prices. If there's more money coming in, that they can reinvest that money in infrastructure, that the internet would be better performing if they were able to do that. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't buy that argument. They're already investing in the infrastructure. And by the way, them investing in that infrastructure returns a handsome profit for them. And I'm not begrudging them for making money. That's fine. That's the American way. But I don't think that they need the gutting of net neutrality to invest more in infrastructure. They're doing that. They're going to continue to do that. And I don't buy that argument.
General, you're a Democrat, and so are the 21 other attorneys general who joined in this suit. You know, politics seems to cloud everything today. Is this a partisan issue?
I can't tell you why Republicans didn't join this suit. It's sort of mind-boggling to me because these issues are the same in Pennsylvania as they are in Arkansas, for example, just to name one particular state where there's a Republican attorney general. I don't get why they didn't join. I can tell you that the majority of actions I've taken with my colleague attorneys general have been bipartisan. Now, granted, the media may cover just the ones where only Democrats are aligned or only Republicans are aligned, but of all the actions I've taken, more have been bipartisan than of a single party. This seems to me to be an issue that should not be clouded by partisanship. And in fact, I have been working with a Republican attorney general from another part of the country on a potential solution here. And politics don't cloud our discussions. We've been working very closely together on something that I think can be helpful to consumers all across the country.
Can you say who?
Not at this time.
Okay. All right. So what's next with net neutrality with your suit?
Well, we've taken the steps. It's sort of a boring legal process, so I don't want to put your listeners to sleep. Your show is too good for that. But basically, we're in the early procedural stages now. We technically have to wait for the final rule to be published by the FCC, and then our formal lawsuit can be filed. What we've basically filed so far is a placeholder to say that we will be filing our lawsuit. So that's just a lot of procedural stuff that we have to go through as lawyers. But what the public really needs to know is a lawsuit will be there to protect them, protect the Internet as we know it, and stop the gutting of net neutrality.
General, I only have a couple more minutes left with you because you are about to get to the Eagles parade. I hope you have a parking spot picked out because that may be a little bit difficult today.
Yeah, I think we're just dealing with it the way everybody else is. Everybody's in a great mood, so we'll figure it out.
Consumer issues and Equifax, that was another suit you're involved in. I've noticed a lot of news coming from your office with some consumer issues. Maybe you can talk about, maybe Equifax is a good one. There was the security breach a while back, and you were part of actions with other attorneys general on that. Understand there could be some news there?
Yeah, so we're actually leading a 48-state investigation into Equifax. And by the way, you asked me about partisanship and bipartisanship. I mean, this is a great example where everybody's been impacted, Democratic and Republican attorneys general working very closely together on it. And I'm proud that Pennsylvania is the lead state. 143 million Americans, including 5.4 million Pennsylvanians, had their data compromised. And listen, I mean, Equifax's only job was to protect our data, and they failed miserably at it. And then it appears that they failed to notify Pennsylvania and other states in a timely fashion. And to be candid with you and your listeners, they haven't been all that great to work with since then. You'd expect that they'd be bending over backwards to protect consumers. We've had to hold them accountable by making sure they had free credit monitoring and credit freeze opportunities for Pennsylvanians who are affected, and we did that. We are now pouring through just a tremendous amount of documents to figure out when the breach occurred, why it occurred, and then make sure we recover for Pennsylvanians. And look, I think there's a broader story here, whether it's Equifax or Uber or the subsidiary of PayPal. I mean, just to name the latest three data breaches, before that you had Target, of course. Until companies recognize that they have to not put an extra dollar of profit in their pocket and instead put that dollar into protecting people's data and information in their companies, we're going to continue to have these breaches. And it is incredibly concerning to me, which is why the ultimate goal of this Equifax investigation is not just to recover, money for our, for Pennsylvania and other states, but to make sure that we change corporate behavior and set an example here about how corporations need to behave when it comes to protecting our data. And that's just one example. I've made consumer protection a key part of my focus and the focus of the Attorney General's office. We've sued Navient, formerly Sallie Mae, to protect student loan holders because of some of their predatory practices. We settled a major case with Volkswagen and Western Union, which brought tens of millions of dollars in added protections to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So we do that every day, and we've made a particular focus to fight to protect consumers. And in fact, we returned in 2017 $1.1 million in money that had been scammed out of the pockets of seniors. So we've made consumer protection a huge focus, trying to protect people online, protect our seniors, protect others, and we're having positive results.
One final question, because I thought I heard a door open there in the car. But I'm curious, when you say that Equifax hasn't exactly been cooperative, in what way?
Well, we have had, it's like pulling teeth to get them to agree to credit freezes, for example, for Pennsylvanians who are affected. Or, they actually tried to charge Pennsylvanians initially to have their credit monitored after they caused the problem here. They tried to get Pennsylvanians early on to waive their legal rights when they signed up for an Equifax credit monitoring service. Now, we've, of course, forced them to back down on all those things, but the fact is it shouldn't take a warning from the Attorney General. They should want to be better partners with their customers, better partners with the consumers that have been affected because of their wrongdoing. And that, to me, is offensive. And I think that Equifax ultimately will pay for this.
Attorney General Josh Shapiro, have a good time today. Wish the family have a good time. It's going to be a historic day in Philadelphia today.
It's a great day for Philly. And I know we got Steelers fans on the phone. And, of course, when they're not playing the Eagles, I root for the Steelers. But I think every Pennsylvanian should be proud of this team. And we have seven rings now in Pennsylvania, albeit six of them are out in Pittsburgh, which is great. But this team is just special. They're gutsy. They're tough. They've all overcome adversity. And they really represent Philadelphians, Pennsylvanians. We fight hard, and they're just an inspiration to so many. And they all have really wonderful stories. And I think it's going to be a really special day and an historic day in Philadelphia and here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
General Shapiro, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, bringing quality care to your community through Harrisburg, Community Osteopathic, West Shore, Carlisle, Hanover, Lancaster, Lititz, and Memorial Hospitals. More information is available at upmcpinnacle.com.
What a week it has been on Wall Street. Last Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped by 666 points. Then on Monday, the Dow lost another 1,175 points before rebounding on Tuesday and then again losing a little bit yesterday. This comes as the stock market was setting record highs for the last year. So what's behind the wild swing? What does it mean for the economy? And what impact could it have on you? Our guest during this portion of the program is Scott Ehrig, who is co-chief investment officer with FMA Advisory. Mr. Ehrig, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Scott. It's great to be here.
Scott Ehrig is, when we talk about history, this is the 10th year of Smart Talk, which started off as Radio Smart Talk, and you were on the very first program. So
it's like old home week,
It is. And we were talking about, at that time, in 2008, we were talking about an economy that had bottomed out. It was not just the stock market.
Right.
Today, it's very much a different atmosphere with the economy, but I think it did surprise a lot of people how much of a drop we saw last Friday, and then the big drop, the nosedive on Monday. So the broad question, Scott, is what's up with the stock market?
The stock market is actually functioning very normally, and that's the real thing. The underlying fundamentals in the economy change much slower then stock prices adjust. And so when we see the stock market move like that without a big change in the underlying economy, it's usually a short-lived problem and nothing to be concerned with. Back in 2008, we were worried that the financial system globally was freezing up, that banks would not be able to make loans or meet basically their capital requirements, and the Federal Reserve had to take extraordinary measures. This is very different.
When you say acting normally, I mean, it gets a lot of people's attention when you lose 666 points and 1,175
sure.
in one day. I mean, that was the biggest point drop by the Dow
correct.
In one day. Percentage-wise, we're going to talk about that in just a moment, but percentage-wise, it wasn't that big of a drop. But that doesn't seem normal when you have that big of a drop.
I would actually say it wasn't even within the top 100 drops of all time. I think it snuck in around 98 or 99 on a percentage basis. And you're right, 1,175 points, while notionally or the actual point drop itself was the biggest, it pales in comparison with Black Monday back in October of 1987. I was in college at the time, so that was 30 years ago, and that was a 22.6% drop. Now, in point terms, it was only 508, but the stock market had been acting abnormally on the way up. For the first 18 trading days of the year, we saw 14 record highs out of those 18 days. That's very abnormal in and of itself. Unprecedented is a word that's tossed around too frequently, but that truly was unprecedented. And I would suggest that this pullback is basically getting us back to neutral.
If you have a question or a comment about the stock market in particular, maybe about the economy as it relates to the stock market, we'd like to hear from you today. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call, or you can send a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that's 1-800-729-7532 if you have a question or a comment about the stock market. I want to take a step back, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
For the last year, and maybe even longer than that, I know that President Trump likes to say that this rally started when he was elected, but actually it started a little bit before mm-hmm. that. I mean, we were breaking all kinds of records, shattering 24,000,
yes.
25,000, 26,000. I mean, to levels that people never would have imagined just a few years ago. So let's talk about the factors that went into that bull market. What happened where the markets just were breaking records?
Okay, it actually goes back to resetting the decks after the financial crisis. Interest rates were kept low for a very long time. And even though the Europeans made fun of us initially when we first spoke about this subject years ago, how could we let the mortgage sector and the housing sector get so far out of control? They did not take their medicine and clean up their banks the way we did here. And so whether or not you're a fan of Dodd-Frank, the banks took their medicine.
What is Dodd-Frank, just for explanation?
Dodd-Frank is the act in Congress that basically forces banks to increase their capital levels and clean up some trading problems that were out there, mm-hmm. particularly with hedge funds and things like that. So it was designed to basically rein in Wall Street a little bit, which is like the Wild West under the best of circumstances. But it encouraged, it discouraged risk-taking by some of the big banks. And that was really what was behind the issues in 2008. So now that they've taken their medicine and the economy has continued to grow steadily, the economy lacked a lot of vigor compared to previous recoveries. So it was kind of a long, slow burn. And I liken it to going camping and not pushing all your wood into the campfire early in the evening, and you have enough to make it last quite a long time. So the economy grew on a slow and steady pace, a rather lackluster pace, but for quite some time. So companies were increasing profits. Corporate earnings to this run-up recently, earnings have been growing for 17 straight quarters. And even last year, earnings on the S&P 500 are up 17% on a year-over-year basis. So companies were making money, and that those earnings are what really drive, at the end of the day, stock market prices. The stock market is a real-time processor of economic data. Okay, now the participants, investors, are driven by greed and fear. Okay, so there's emotion in it. And when you combine those two things, the real beauty of it is that over time, the stock market gets it right. But in short-term swings, like we just saw, the market can respond very violently.
And I think that's probably why it surprised many laymen, is that, and I don't know, maybe those who work in your industry, too, were a little bit surprised. You probably knew it was coming, but maybe not at the level it was. But that, you know, it's not like we've corporate profits have fallen at all. The Federal Reserve has increased interest rates slightly. I mean, when you compare what the interest rates are to what they were 20 years ago, maybe even shorter than that, I mean, it's still nothing when you can get a mortgage for 3%, 3.5%, 4% compared to, 6, 7, 8%, something like that.
Right.
But anyway, a lot of the economic factors are still positive, very, very positive. Actually, earnings are up a little bit. Wages are up a little bit. There are some other factors. So why, if all the economic indicators are so positive, why all of a sudden one day 666 points?
Fear and greed. And so people, we really don't know exactly what caused it because, to your point, Scott, the underlying fundamentals didn't change. Bull markets don't die of their own deaths typically, or they're usually caused by some external factor, what we call an exogenous event. And the biggest three-point drop since 2015 was what we experienced last Thursday, Friday, and Monday. I mean, it was a big drop. That was clearly caused by China. When they revalued their currency and surprised the entire world, that's the big kind of shock that would normally recalibrate economic expectations. But there really wasn't any of that in this particular circumstance. Were there risks building? Sure. Inflation risks are starting to perk up, and most people are ascribing it to that. But there are a couple other things going on. Interest rates moving higher in response to the inflation risks, valuation risks. Stocks were expensive on basis of earnings, not outrageously so, but they had been marching steadily higher. There's political risk, the Trump administration playing defense with the Russia probe and everything else. So it's not like there were no risks at all that investors had to consider, but the underlying fundamentals are very, very strong. Again, earnings up sharply, 17%. That's a big number. Wage growth at 2.9%. That's not fantastic, but it's a pretty good number. The economic backdrop globally is very strong. For the first time in 10 years, all 45 major economies are ramping up in synchronization. That's a really positive thing for the United States and for economies everywhere. That hasn't changed. Even laggards like Greece and Brazil have turned up lately. So that's a really strong backdrop with inflation finally getting back to the Fed's target. They've been trying to get inflation to 2%. And just for the first time in their announcement last week, they said, we think we might actually get there this year. It's not bad news necessarily. We're finally getting to their target.
Consumers don't like to hear that, but
well, if their wages are growing at 2.9, they're ahead of the game. And so I really think that this was the most benign of causes when people looked around and said, you know what? Interest rates might start to go up in response to what has been generally good news in the economy. Nothing really fundamentally has changed. There's no big damage, and I don't think any damage has been done to the economy by this pullback, unlike Black Monday, when certainly there was damage done to the economy because it was so much and it was prolonged.
Something that, when you talked about China having a great impact last week,
mm-hmm.
A perfect example of how we are in a global economy nowadays. When did that change, or was it just that we didn't notice it before? I mean, when we talked about the recovery from 2008, I think about times where the economy here and the stock market was in a bit of a slump when there were problems in Greece, for example. And many people were asking, why or how is Greece impacting what's happening in the United States? That global economy, obviously we are in a global economy today, but when did that change?
That really started to change after World War II. What's so interesting about the current political climate is that this administration seems keen on upending the world order as we kind of wrote it in Washington and paid for it on Wall Street, where we are the leader of a global economy and where trade is valued and everybody sort of wins. But the low-hanging fruit of outsourcing jobs and putting production to low-cost countries, much of that is behind us, but it's been a trend that's been going on for decades now. We are more aware of it than we ever have been. And I would say that China's entry in the World Trade Organization, they were pushing for that for a very long time. That probably accelerated it and brought them, made us more cognizant of that as well and accelerated the trend. But it's been going on for decades. Now there just aren't that many places that have workers that are less expensive than China. I mean, Vietnam and some other places, but we certainly have trade. We have telecommunications that have shrunk the world. It's been going on for quite some time.
Our guest today is Scott Ehrig, co-chief investment officer with FMA Advisory. We're talking about the stock market over the past week. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, 1-800-729-7532. I don't think Scott is going to give any stock tips or anything like that today. We don't do that, but talking about the markets in general. And, of course, I think a good question is, and one that we will ask, is what impact this does have on you. So many people out there who are, you know, looking at their 401ks or if they are investors. So, I mean, that is a legitimate question. 1-800-729-7532. You talked about the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that I hear many people surprised that the stock market has responded the way it has during the Trump administration because, let's face it, there has been a lot of controversy. There has been some chaos. There have been a lot of political infighting, you know, going back and forth. I mean, we keep having these, continuing resolutions of, we go a month with a budget. Now we may have one for 2 years, may or may not. But there's a lot of uncertainty, and the markets don't like uncertainty. So I guess that's why many people are still surprised that over the past year of the Trump administration that the stock market has reacted the way it has.
Well, you brought that point up earlier as well, that he's taking credit. And frankly, the economy moves quite slowly. It changes direction very, very slowly. So the groundwork was laid in previous administrations. There's no question about that. So does he get to take credit because he's in the big chair? Yes, he does. And he can point to it if it's to his advantage, but the groundwork was laid long ago. I would argue that the stock market has gone up a little bit more or a little bit higher because of his policies of lightening regulation, okay, and improving financial conditions on Wall Street, scaling back some of that regulation and making people more excited about investing for the future. So he has unleashed some of that with respect to animal spirits and encouraging business owners and entrepreneurs to take risks and executives to pull plans that they've had on the shelf for a long time off the shelf and say, hey, let's go. It's time for us to do that and to put this project in motion. But really, the inertia was there long before he arrived.
In reading about this week, and you know, there were so many opinions, and of course, you do this every day.
Mm-hmm.
But one opinion that I did read is that the tax cut that was enacted in December and signed into law by the president in December, I think the president used the words that we will throw fuel on the fire of this economy and really get it moving, that there are some economists who have said too much, that there was too much fuel put on the fire, and that this economy, this market, can't handle that kind of growth. What about that?
It's a shot of adrenaline to an economy that's already strong and firing on all eight cylinders. We don't really need it now. Business owners will take it. It is stimulative for the economy in some respects, but it's when we end up paying for it by issuing debt in the long term, I would say it's more prudent for us to use our position of economic strength to pay down debt rather than to issue more debt.
Well, when you're talking about issuing debt, mm-hmm. bonds. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one of the factors pointed to. What has the bond market been doing, and how has that impacted the stock market?
Bonds have been losing price as interest rates have gone up on expectations that the Fed is going to raise at least three times this year because the economic data has come in almost universally positive. The first 3-4 weeks of this year were all about accelerating economic growth. And there's a psychological phenomenon known as recency bias, where folks pay more attention to things that have happened in the recent past and tend to discount things that occurred long ago. And that's why the stock market kept going higher and higher and higher. People forgot that trees don't grow to the sky because things are good, things are good, things are better, things are better. And so that's what Wall Street got caught up in. This recent adjustment kind of centers us back to a more normal, I would say, operating posture. But the thing that got a lot of people's attention is, okay, interest rates on the 10-year went from 2.45 to almost 3%, 2.85, over just a couple of days. And so, yes, the markets are pricing in the fact that the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates, and inflation, while still low by historical standards, is now something that we have to watch.
So in simple terms, you know, those interest rates mm-hmm. provide another vehicle or vehicles for investors
absolutely
to get a return on their investments.
And for the first time in a while, they're almost attractive. Okay, so we have seen some trades where people were using high-yielding stocks or high-dividend-paying stocks as income replacement vehicles. Some of the bloom has come off that rose, and they have cycled out now probably into bonds.
Where do you see the bond market going?
Well, I've lost a case of beer and a bet last year that we'd get to 3% on the 10-year.
Oh, you guys have your little wagers going on, huh?
Yes, we do. Of course we do. And so that was good beer, too, as a matter of fact. I was probably 3 or 4 months early that we'd hit 3% on the 10-year. We really don't know where they're going to go. And interest rates over the course of 17 and early 18 basically just retraced the same path. It started at about 2.6% at the beginning of 17, and we're right back there again now.
You said attractive. Well, I think what you said was almost attractive
rates. Right.
What do you call attractive?
That really depends on a person's required rate of return, and that is derived from figuring out where they want to go and the returns they need to achieve their financial goals. And bonds, of course, produce current income, but the real reason for holding them is the stabilizing aspect that they put in a portfolio, even more so than the income that they create. So some investors need a higher return to get where they want to go. It introduces more drama along the journey. But for some folks, 2.5-3% return where Pennsylvania municipal bonds are trading now is good enough for part of their portfolio.
So much of this is psychological with what has happened over the past week. And you have to call it volatile when, you know,
sure.
one day you lose 666, almost 1,200 the next, and then, you know, goes up over 300 the day after that, back down 19 points yesterday. But so much of this is psychological. Will there be people, and maybe there already are, people who are saying, oh, I want to go toward bonds because it is safer. It is, even though I'm not getting that 9, 10, 15, 20% return that I have over the past few years with the stock market, I'm a little bit afraid or cautious of what's going on. So I'll take that 3% right now.
Sure. And one of the things that as we dug into the data and the trading flows on Monday, which was, of course, the really big drop, there was a big surge of individual or retail investor orders coming through the pipes 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when it was down the most. So people were definitely experiencing some fear when things got really bad, when the market was off over 1,000. And at one point it was like 1,600. I mean, it was a big drop. So when they look, the fear is certainly part of it. That's where, quite frankly, people make mistakes. People make mistakes when they abandon their investment discipline, when they get off track, when they don't stick to their plan. And that's the value, frankly, of a trusted advisor, okay? Everybody in this business likes to think that they're smarter than the next guy, and it just frankly isn't true, okay? We don't make the rules of investing, but a good advisor will actually understand their clients well, what sort of volatility that and risk that they're willing and able to take on and develop a plan for them. And then after that, you rebalance the portfolio. The whole idea is to keep a steady hand on the tiller and not let people make mistakes and abandon their discipline at moments of despair or euphoria when the market's getting too rich. And that's why we rebalance portfolios regularly to sell things that are richly valued, stocks are relatively expensive, and buy things that are inexpensive.
Did you get a lot of phone calls from clients on Monday?
We got some, but actually not that many. Some of them were outbound originally for the folks that, you know, don't necessarily sleep as well as at night as I tend to. And so we did a little of that, but we only had, I would say, out of a client base of 1,000 folks, maybe 10 phone calls.
Really?
Yeah.
So not a lot of panic.
No, no. And to your point earlier, there wasn't really anything fundamental going wrong.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing the volatility of the stock market over the past week or so with Scott Ehrig, co-chief investment officer with FMA Advisory. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So many of us, Scott, that our investments are tied up in our retirement plans, 401ks. And, you know, I did hear and read on social media of people said, okay, now I'm concerned about the 401k because this is what I have for my my later years, my retirement years. So what impact would it have on the individual investors? I mean, that maybe if 401ks, that is how you do invest, or that is how you you work in the stock market. What impact has the last week had on those people?
Well, clearly, if the investor is someone who looks at their account values every day, they woke up on Tuesday morning and saw that their statements were updated, and they were not happy, okay, that obviously the markets had pulled back. But again, 4.6% on stocks is not a really big deal in the grand scheme of things. This is part of the risk you have to take if you want to play this game. It's part of the price of the admission that the market does not go up universally, positively, and the experience in January was exceedingly rare. In fact, it's never really happened that way. Where on 18 trading days, 14 new record highs. That was unusual. And so it makes everybody enthusiastic to go online and see where they're at now. They're tracking ahead of schedule, perhaps. This brings people back on schedule, but the fact that it's a 401k and you've got dollars coming in consistently, just keep doing that, because now you're buying, your next purchase will be those same assets at slightly lower values, and that's okay.
The even with the losses on Friday and Monday, if your money is tied up in a 401k for retirement, it's still worth much more than it was two years ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All we did is give up the gains from the turn of the calendar year to date. You're still looking at a 20%+ return on U.S. stocks from 2017. And so the large cap ones were up even more, about 24% on the S&P 500, and somewhat less than that in small caps. But overall, a 20% return on stocks is quite good.
Small caps.
Small caps were around 14% or so.
Okay. Yeah. You talked about someone getting up on Tuesday morning and looking at their portfolio. I've always heard it's not a good idea to check every day.
It isn't. It really isn't. It's better to, again, make sure that you've sat down and crafted a plan that makes sense for you, that gets you from point A to point B in your financial life with the least amount of drama. If you like white knuckle rides, Hershey Park is right up the road, okay? But it's not something you really want to do in terms of your finances. So if you've set the plan in a period of relative calm with a trusted advisor who's modeled different scenarios for you, your portfolio is built to take down days like Monday.
You know, a lot of times when there are some scary times on Wall Street, there are other people who see it as an opportunity. Are there opportunities out there now?
Certainly. If you have some cash and there are quality names that you like their long-term prospects, chances are they are cheaper now. chances are that they've also probably gone down a little bit less if they're blue chip companies with strong balance sheets and high dividend payments. They're typically less volatile. Okay, so those names have gone down, but you can buy quality at a lower price than you could 2 weeks ago.
And, you know, I've been quoting the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the past week, and the media often does that because it's the big, when you see an 1,175-point drop,
right,
that's the one that makes news, as opposed to the S&P 500 or, other stocks. But probably that is not the one to look at, correct?
That is correct. That is a weighted average of 30 stocks, whereas the S&P 500 represents all the major sectors in the U.S. economy and is by professionals considered to be the best representation of the large cap stock space.
So if I want to look to see how the stock market is doing on the S&P 500, what do I look for? What kind of numbers?
Well, you would look for total return. Okay, stocks pay dividends, and they also, the price moves as well. So you would see that the S&P 500 has done quite well. I mean, last year was up 24%. Okay, this year it has given back those gains, but that's all right. And that's their return numbers. You have to be careful when you're looking and researching for yourself. Is it just the price change, or does it also include the dividend stream? And the higher the stock prices go, if the dividends remain constant, the yield actually comes in a little bit. It comes down a little bit. So it might be yielding 1.9% or so these days.
You know, we talked earlier about taking credit for the tremendous increase in the stock market over the past year or so. But again, something else that we've heard from many people this week, people in the know, is that the stock market is not really a good indicator of the health of the economy.
That's correct.
Why not?
It's disconnected from the economy. It is a projection. It's supposed to really indicate where the economy is going 6 to 9 months out. Okay, again, it's a forward-looking indicator. Now, the health of corporations and companies generally does translate into the health of individuals and families and their paychecks and things like that. If the economy is doing badly, the prospects for stocks and their companies that are represented by those securities generally goes down, but it's not a direct connection, that's for sure.
You know, the frightening part for a lot of people is that this is a trend, and that even though it may be a correction over a few days now, that it's a trend that, with interest rates going up and, some of the other factors in the economy, that there will be more days where there will be losses and that those losses will be as big as Friday or Monday. What do you think?
Well, there will be days with losses, that much we know, and there will be days in the future with losses as big or bigger than we just experienced. But the backdrop is still strong. We look at a number of indicators to say, is this really a fundamental problem? And it gets a little geeky, it gets a little technical, but we look under the hood and say, all right, where are the risky assets moving right now? And so when we look at junk bonds, for example, they would normally sell off quite sharply. They behave more like stocks than bonds in times of real stress. They didn't sell off very much at all. We look at the backdrop. The Purchasing Manager Index, which is an index of companies and the prices that they pay and their expectations going forward. In Europe, the highest since 2007. In China, they just reported the highest since 2012. The IMF has been raising their economic growth forecasts for the global economy. The U.S. economy is doing well. More people are going back to work. We see unemployment at very low levels. So again, the backdrop is strong, and there was nothing really fundamental to cause the pullback. The last three pullbacks, two of them were caused by China. We had an issue with Brexit, you'll recall, a couple years ago, or when oil went below $28 a barrel. Folks finally realized that even though low energy prices are usually good for stocks and good for the economy, when they get too low, it flips and becomes a very bad thing. And so those were the sources of much of the angst in the stock market over the last couple of years, and each time it recovered because the fundamentals were still fairly strong.
You know, it's hard to tell. It's hard to predict when there would be an issue, but some kind of I don't know, even the hurricanes that we had over the past summer didn't seem to have that much of an impact. But natural disaster or some kind of international tension or something like that, could that impact the stock market?
It certainly could. Now, if we get into a nuclear conflict on the Korean Peninsula, that would dramatically impact trade for years to come. And that would be a huge exogenous shock, again, an external shock that we would want to avoid. Most often, it's Federal Reserve policymakers raising interest rates too far, too quickly, that squelch growth and invert the yield curve. And so that's usually what causes things, barring an exogenous shock like you just described.
We have a new chairman of the Federal Reserve. Does that create any kind of uncertainty?
Of course it does. And he was tested on the very first day, just as Greenspan was tested less than 2 months in back with Black Monday.
Right.
It's interesting that these things come along, but Powell, even though he does not have a PhD in economics, he has a lot of experience in the capital markets, and I think he was very wise not to jump in, because if he did, he would have been a slave to the stock market for the rest of his tenure. Greenspan did back in 87, because that percentage drop was so severe that it damaged the economy and people didn't understand what was really going to come. So not only did Chairman Greenspan, but other central bankers around the world also lowered interest rates in unison to provide confidence and liquidity for financial markets. And then, even though people were very concerned that we'd entered a new era of volatility and growth and that permanent damage had been done, the rest of 87 and into 88, the stock market did well.
We only have about 30 seconds left, Scott. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So in 30 seconds or less, what do you see coming?
We see more volatility. We see that stocks will probably recover from here and continue their march higher, barring some change in the underlying fundamentals.
Scott Arick is the co-chief investment officer with FMA Advisory. Scott, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, replacing nuclear power with renewable energy sources and where the nation is going with that. We'll also learn a little bit about the expansion of WITF's State Impact Pennsylvania project that reports on Pennsylvania's energy economy. That's also coming up tomorrow, so be sure to tune in.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by Pinnacle Health Spine Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, offering a complete range of services to diagnose and treat your spine condition. More information is available at upmcpinnacle.com/spine.